Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. Welcome back to another wacky and wonderful week in South Africa. I'm your host, Peter Sarma, and today I'm joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
No, I'm okay, just regretting the public holidays that are no longer with us for next year.
Indeed. It's a long drought now until we get June 16th, and then another long drought until Heritage Day, which is unfortunately on a Saturday and therefore isn't really a public holiday. So the winter of our discontent will, I think, soon set in. Inflation, all these terrible things going on. But anyway, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
We're so well, problem.
Mr. Herman Pretorius, how are you, Herman?
I'm well, but now that, I mean, the previous winter of discontent was followed by the Margaret Thatcher premiership. So, you know, hope springs eternal.
No, exactly, exactly. That's always worth remembering.
I thought the last winter of discontent led to rioting in KZN.
Well, yes, but, you know, maybe our second go at it will do it correctly this time. And you know.
Yes, I think core
inflation,
to this is
oil prices.
The grave diggers haven't gone on strike yet. So
yes,
that's a key indicator of a new Thatcher era.
Okay. All right, so let's get into our first story for today, and this is one about firearms. So anyone who has tried to get a firearm legally in South Africa knows that it can be a bit of a pain in the backside. But now there seems to be yet more ways in which you can get denied for a firearms license. So this story has caused quite a fuss, as you can imagine, because it is a rather emotive issue. A woman from the Eastern Cape was applying for a firearms license. She had gone through the proposal, through everything, and she was going to get her photograph done for her firearms license. Now, this woman is very strictly Muslim, and so she wears the hijab covering her face. Now, for the photograph, she said, "That's fine, I'll take the hijab off of my face so that you can see me for the photograph," which is, I think, everyone thinks is pretty much fair. However, she was also told that she needed to take off the headscarf portion of her hijab. So in other words, it wasn't enough to just simply uncover her face. She also needed to uncover her hair as well. And this she refused to do. She said, "I took off my veil that covered my face, but I was not willing to take off the headscarf. For me, it's more than a piece of cloth. It's my honor and my dignity. It's my identity as a woman." She was then denied her license, saying that she was not cooperating and her photo wasn't suitable. This has drawn a lot of condemnation from some South African gun rights groups. Gun owners of South Africa said that this was unacceptable. The Girls on Fire group, which is a group that strongly supports women legally buying, training and owning firearms, was also very upset about this. They said that it's completely within the rules for someone who's showing their face to still be able to wear a covering over their hair if it's for religious reasons. Terence, what do you make of this story? You have some experience in dealing with some of the systems of the Central Firearms Registry. Is this the first time something like this has happened?
No, this is sort of par for the course. I think there's maybe two things at stake here. One is just the general chaos. This is interestingly an issue that unites gun rights and anti-gun organizations. As a functioning firearms registry is basically central to either regulating legal firearm ownership or abolishing it and confiscating everyone's guns. So kind of everyone wants one to exist, or at least, you know, all the stakeholders. Yet its performance since it was established has been suboptimal, to say the least. And what seems to be going on here is just more of this sort of general incompetence. We've got a situation where the volume of paper is uncleared firearms applications is so has reached a point where it's causing structural damage to the building. I mean, just think about this: the paper itself just weighs too much. It really has to be a special kind of dysfunction when you reach that point. In the paper.
How is that possible?
You just stacked like, you know, a gazillion you know, unprocessed forms on top of each other, and apparently it can bend steel. You know, read your Tolkien, you know, why are trolls associated with stone and ents with wood? Because wood ultimately over time cracks stone. And, you know, incompetence cracks architecture, I suppose. So, yeah, this is the, you know, this is just the sort of central firearms registry dysfunction. And the, I think, breakdown of the licensing system. Now, 20 months. Yeah, that's not unusual. I think that there are probably some people, you know, who will find their applications just sit, you know, spinning around the great toilet bowl of our bureaucracy, you know, for the rest of their lives. You know, and you just have your proof of payment and, you know, off you go. But, you know, the other thing is that the issue of picture ID in South Africa, this is not the first time it's come up. In 2020, there was a Muslim lady in, I think it was in the Western Cape, who applied for an ID card, and she was also required to remove her, headscarf. Now, the rules in this are actually, I think, quite fair that, you're not allowed to have any kind of ornamentation unless it's for religious reasons. So a Jewish guy can have a kippah if he feels this is, particularly important. A Sikh can have a turban. A Muslim woman can choose to have a headscarf. Obviously, you know, you're looking for the ordinal details of the face. And you know what you're able to do with your hair. I mean, it's probably the easiest feature to alter anyway. So, yeah, you know, this is there've been some suggestions, I think, from that article you were quoting from, that this was Islamophobic or whatever. I'm not 100% sure that is necessarily correct, but you know, it could have something to do with that. But once again, this is just the latest in a long, sad, tragic, frustrating progression of examples of state officials not doing their jobs properly.
So, Herman, I wanted your thoughts on this. And, you know, listening to Terence talk about the problems with the firearms registry, I really get the sense that this is a great example of how just the pure inefficiency and inflexibility of bureaucracy in of itself can be something that intrudes on other more core rights of people beyond just the right to sort of good governance, but also the right for, in this case, to religious expression. What do you make of this?
Yeah, and I think it's more, it's religious expression and more. It's also, you know, personal safety. The last time I was on Daily Friend, I think we spoke about, the legal action that we had to take on behalf of the Forum for Democrats in the Northwest to get the IEC's miscalculation corrected. And that wasn't malevolent, but it was just plain old good old incompetence that almost robbed the voters of a specific voting district of their constitutional right to participate in democracy in a free and fair election. And again, here one should never underestimate the toxicity of just bloated, behemothic incompetence on a state level. You don't always have to have, you know, Chairman Mao under the bed or CRT under the bed. Quite oftentimes, you just need enough of a lack of accountability and oversight for long enough that the very notion of competence disappears from the state. It really is quite amazing how poorly South Africa compares, not you know, with our civil service.
Not just that. I mean, I don't know exactly what happened, but I can imagine a scene in my mind where she takes off her veil and she's sitting down for the photo, and then the official says, no, you have to take off your headscarf. She argues with them, and then the official points at a line of text on a piece of paper and says, no, but it says here. No, these are the rules. You have to follow them. These are exact procedures. And I think anyone who's dealt with that bureaucracy, you know, you got the wrong form. You filled in a piece of information slightly incorrectly. You didn't stand in the right line. And the bureaucracy treats you as, less than human.
Yeah, no, and the thing also here that I can very well, I sort of similarly construct a scene in my mind as to what happened. It's not difficult to make the jump that perhaps the official involved was, you know, there are a few options, either malicious in the sense that this is a Muslim person and they sort of have an anti-Muslim sentiment. That's not impossible. I'm not jumping to that, but that's a possibility. Or they were lazy in the sense that this was just outside of what they were willing to do that day. So they are just going to be obstructive and obtrusive. I've dealt with officials like that, in renewing vehicle licenses and so on. Or there's another level here where they were, you know, legislatively illiterate in a way that they couldn't understand the regulations or the law that they were trying to apply. And I've encountered that as well. So that cuts two ways in the sense that some regulations and laws are so stupidly written that I remember early in lockdown, Anthea Jeffrey and I were reading a piece of legislation. And for what it's worth, I've nominally got an LLB and Anthea's got, you know, all the LLDs in the world or whatever. And neither of us could figure out what exactly the specific piece of regulation was saying. So there's the one end where these regulations and laws are drafted so jargonistically and so removed from actual good governance. But on the other hand, you also have a state, a civil service that quite often don't understand the regulations and the laws that they are supposed to either enforce or abide by. So in this scene in my mind, I really can just see at every level this thing going wrong, ticking every box of frustration for this poor woman who wants the right to defend herself. And the idea of identifying a facial identification, we're all fine with that and in favor of that. She cleared that bar, that this cocktail of ignorance, malevolence, and incompetence just sort of spinballed into the wonderful product that is the South African Civil Service. It's disheartening.
I really like, Terence, your phrase earlier of the toilet bowl of bureaucracy. Do you have any final thoughts before we move on?
No, it's just that I, although I won't get into the details, as you guys know, I have a similar issue, which has been going on for something like 4 years now, trying to resolve an impasse because something was a little bit outside the kind of mainstream. There are procedures for it, but no one can tell you quite what they are. And, you know, you just get to wait.
Indeed. All right. Let us move on to our next topic. And this comes from the Financial Intelligence Center and especially their legal and policy division executive manager, Peter Smith, who talked to Times Live or the Sunday Times about an issue that his organization is very concerned with. And in this particular case, it is networks from South Africa which are funding terrorist activities abroad, particularly the terrorist activities of the Islamic State, or ISIS, as it used to be known, Al-Qaeda and its affiliates such as Al-Shabaab in Somalia. He said that there are definitely funding flows to East Africa and to these networks, which in some cases supply people with money in these areas. He said it's not even a possibility. It happens in practice. There are people in SA who attempted to and actually left to travel to Syria to join the Islamic State and became a part of its caliphate. Recently, U.S. authorities listed four people who were South African citizens and residents and sanctioned them for their links to raising funds for the Islamic State. A lot of the concern here seems to be focused on the informal sector, so presumably, you know, kind of small businesses of various kinds, spas or shops, sort of semi-legal, half-registered businesses, those kind of things, which may in some cases be sending some of this money back. And it seems like there are not very many good mechanisms for tracking money to find out where exactly it might be going. There are, of course, many people who send remittances, foreigners like, you know, famously like Somali shopkeepers and stuff who are sending remittances back to their families for the money they own here. But it's clear that at least a little bit of this money is also finding its way into the hands of terror groups around the world, particularly in Africa. You know, when you think about our big Somali community here, I would not be surprised if at least a little bit of the money being sent back is ending up somehow, maybe deliberately or undeliberately, in the hands of a group like Al-Shabaab, which is Al-Qaeda's franchise in Somalia. Herman, let me start with you on this one. What do you make of the story? Clearly, you know, I remember a report from a long time ago, I think it was 2012, 2013, somewhere around there, but that during the Thabo Mbeki administration, our intelligence services actually have found that there was the possibility of an Al-Qaeda training camp in South Africa, maybe on a quite a small scale, and then it was just sort of never really followed up. This is really an area which we're falling down.
I remember that quite well. I think it was in the Karoo somewhere was the sort of idea is that was where the Al-Qaeda training camp was. Now, around that time, 2010, 11, 12, 13, when I was in university and I was doing university debating, one of the topics that we had was something like, you know, South Africa is ready to host the Olympic Games in some year, 2014 or something like that, 12, 16, whatever. And then we strategized. You have an hour to prepare in the format of debate that I participated in, and we strategized for an hour, and we said, oh, well, financially we're not ready, infrastructurally we're not ready, and you sort of need a third argument to take. And then we just said, how about security? How are we on security? And we gave it to our one team member, who said, you've got an hour, look into whether, excuse me, South Africa is ready on a security level to host a big event like this. And he was so annoyed, so irritated. He was like, fine, I'm not going to fine anything. 45 minutes later, he came to us with the biggest eyes ever that I've seen on a colleague in the debating team, just saying, did you guys know that Al-Qaeda is in South Africa? And it just became clear. And I spoke to a security risk analyst a few years ago that said the South African passport was probably the most falsified passport in the world, often used by terror groups and illegal, you know, smugglers or whatever. So South Africa's position in relation to terrorist activities has always been sort of bubbling beneath the surface in a quite sinister way. Now, I don't know anything about that. I'm not a security analyst. I've spoken to people in that world, but very, very superficially. But I do remember one day, you know, reopening the paper where sitting in a restaurant in Pretoria, and they were saying that Samantha Luthwaite, the so-called Black Widow of Al-Qaeda, was rumored to be in South Africa, possibly in Pretoria. And I was just sitting in a restaurant in Pretoria thinking, okay, I've never felt so close to the Middle East. But the point is that South Africa's position as just enough of a continental leader, just enough of a Western country, just enough of a financial, influential, regional actor, with lax security and with corruption in the Home Affairs portfolio of the department, with the availability of falsified documents or easily, you know, available passports and so on, it really does matter greatly in the larger global security context. So with the idea that South Africa is now adding to our repertoire of possible terror opportunities, the idea of, you know, becoming essentially a destination for money laundering, I'm sadly not surprised at all. This is just another consequence of failure at a basic state level. And let's not forget that it's not too long ago that there was an actual arson attack in Durban. I think that was claimed to be someone involved. I don't know whether it was the arsonists themselves, claimed to be acting on behalf of ISIS at the time. So it's a risky business, and it just sort of sends a shiver down your spine to know that in a world of human trafficking, sex trafficking, terrorism, a really dark, dark pit of humanity, South Africa might, through mere and sheer evil incompetence, be contributing a lot of bandwidth to such activities.
And of course, you know, while any government should be cracking down on terrorist activities, it's not just that this is some sort of faraway problem. You know, it's Kenya's problem, it's Somalia's problem, it's Iraq's problem. This is now our problem in the sense that it's right next door. There's of course now an ISIS branch, or an Islamic State branch, that it's set up shop in northern Mozambique, which the South African Defense Force has at least supposedly, although I'm not sure how big of a role they are playing, due to our capacity constraints, but you know, we are involved in fighting this problem in our neighbor. This is a problem that seems to be coming closer to home. Terence, what do you make of this?
I do remember that about 2006, 2007, I think it was Ronnie Castrels, who was the Minister of Intelligence, and he was asked whether there was an Al-Qaeda presence in South Africa, and I think he said yes. Now, ISIS is apparently like a more sinister beast than Al-Qaeda. You know, it's
ISIS are the guys in Al-Qaeda who thought Al-Qaeda was too soft.
Well, there you go. It's unsurprising. Terrorists and terrorist organizations need mobility, and they need the ability to transfer money. And South Africa can provide both of those. Herman's quite correct about the passports. Those have been, that's been an issue for a long time. Think of the South African passport a bit like the Japanese yen in South Africa. Everyone would kind of know about it. It's something you see often enough to be familiar with, if you're a foreign passport officer. So, I once heard an interesting story about a lady from Guatemala who was stopped in Turkey while they checked the country existed. You're not going to have that with South Africa. It's recognizable, but, you know, you're not necessarily going to know very much about it. Which is why if you're going to try and, you know, con someone with a foreign currency, yen's always a good one, because we know Japan's got to be good. It's like, you know, Toyota or something, but, you're not quite sure what that funny exchange rate is. Times Live also carried a sort of companion piece to that one about about terrorist financing, saying that South Africa seems to be a pretty unique country in the world, that former ISIS emigres have been allowed back into the country with no requirements for rehabilitation or for de-radicalization, and they're not being monitored. Now, very, very small numbers, but I think if you're that committed that you sort of up stakes and take your existence to another part of the world and then come back when the Kurdish militia has walked in on you and they're not feeling in a charitable mood, your return to South Africa might be entirely pragmatic. That being said, there's another interesting dynamic here. I feel very strongly about that a claim on citizenship is kind of a bond that cannot be broken. So the South African state does have some responsibilities, you know, even to people who have behaved in a reprobate manner. I do not approve of what the United Kingdom, for instance, did by unilaterally stripping, one of its citizens of her citizenship. But the idea that, people who, feel very unkindly towards South Africa's constitutional democracy and would probably want to, shall we say, look to an alternate form of government, to be kind of assisted to come back and then sort of turned loose. That's, you know, as, my great euphemism, it's not so cool.
Yeah. That's putting it mildly. All right, let's move on, I think, to our final story for today. And this is about the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa. So actually, I think we may have even covered this on the podcast in its earliest days, or maybe that was a little bit before we started the podcast. But anyway, the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa launched this inquest in 2016 into the possibility that MultiChoice, specifically its satellite TV network, DSTV, was effectively a monopoly on South Africa's its satellite broadcasting space. And after 3 years, they published their findings and they said that MultiChoice is in a dominant position, that it controls far too much in the market, and it proposed a couple of remedies such as unbundling sports rights, splitting content rights with more than one broadcaster, limiting the number of Hollywood studios a broadcaster may have an exclusive agreement with, and making sure that decoders can work for multiple networks, not just for, you know, so in other words, you wouldn't just get a DSTV decoder that only works for DSTV. Your decoder would work for whatever network you want to be on. At the time, I believe DSTV said this was unfair and that it didn't take into account some of the developments that have been going on in the broadcasting space, developments which we have only seen the acceleration of over the last couple of years. And this is the massive explosion in foreign online streaming services, everything from the free services like YouTube to Netflix to HBO to Disney Plus, which I believe is arriving in South Africa this month. MultiChoice has now told ICASA that it faces, quote, an existential threat from international streaming providers. So ICASA have decided that MultiChoice might have a bit of a point here, and they've reopened the inquiry to see if it needs some updating on whether MultiChoice really is a dominant player in the market. Herman, what do you make of this?
Well, there's this wonderful little factoid from the Cold War, was that the one of the most desirable pieces of documentation that the Soviets wanted to get from America was their price list for the products, to know how they determine the various prices of, you know, everything from a tractor to a chocolate bar, because they so fundamentally believed that a free market couldn't possibly have any coherence. It can't have the price mechanism can't in and of itself originate the system of relative coherent transactions. That there had to be somewhere in government, there had to be this resource that determined the costs of all goods in America. That was like the holy grail of Soviet spying in a way. It sort of reminds me of this, that the Competition Commission and the state ideologically influencing this commission can believe that somewhere there's a list of allowable products that can be distributed at fair, you know, prices and so on, while ignoring the fact that the market shifts so fast. And this is just another proof of the fact that the market is much more versatile and nimble than anyone really in government considers it to be. The moment you identify something as a monopoly, there's a likelihood that someone is already competing to dethrone it. So I must say, this is just the Competition Commission, which I think has a reason to exist. I do think that competition needs to be maintained and sometimes even governmentally mandated. But this, my dear fellows, is not it. It is proof of the fact that just like the Soviets were chasing a bit of a ghost when they wanted the American price list, the Competition Commission and the ANC socialists in South Africa are chasing after a similar ghost if they think they can control the market and determine when market dominance is actually, you know, now a bad thing. Oh, my goodness, no, things have shifted. Here's Disney Plus. It's just stupid. It shows the shallowness and idiocy of this ideological obsession.
Right, I got to take another 3 years to do another inquiry, and by the time those 3 years are over, we're going to have, you know, I don't know, virtual reality stream or something. Terence, in 2 minutes or so, your thoughts on this?
You know, I think the one thing that MultiChoice really needs to hang on to, which is its existential competitive edge, is its sports broadcasting. Being the last of the great couch potatoes, I can quote Tolkien here again and say, "You have no power over me." Now, just think back. When Mnet launched in the 1980s, it was kind of a niche luxury product that you couldn't get all over the country. Then it expanded and it became part of, you know, middle class households, entertainment packages. DSTV opened up this entire world, satellite feeds from around the world. By about 2010, 2012, you know, the attraction had worn off. You could get your entertainment in another way. The dynamism of technology, I think, gives these things a very, very limited lifespan. To sort of try and hold them up, I don't think it's really viable, whatever arguments you make.
Yeah, and you know, the funny thing about satellite TV is how widespread actually it's become in South Africa now. You know, because this market moves so fast. you can go to squatter cap settlement sometimes, and you will find that the moment people get electricity, satellite dishes start appearing on shacks and things, because, you know, the market moves quickly and people adapt and new products are made that are cheaper and easier and people get internet and all these things. So I get the strong feeling that by the time a CASA makes up its mind as to whether it need, you know, multi-choice needs to be further destroyed, that multi-choice may not even exist anymore.
Well, if I just make one final point about this, in the 1970s, you got your news either from a paper, newspaper, radio, or television. In the 1980s, the same, and that was what made, you know, government control of the SABC such a big thing. 6 o'clock every night, you'd sort of congregate in front of the television to watch the news broadcast. I haven't watched a news broadcast probably in a decade.
Yeah.
Just exactly. Different way of doing things.
All right. That is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. And we will see you tomorrow on The Daily Print Show. Cheers, everyone.